you soon will sing those words. But sadly and certainly, the fears of all the years are met in Bethlehem still. A high wall of barbed wire surrounds the little town today, a wall built to meet the fears of those who live outside the wall, those who, like us, think a wall is our first defense against losing the future we fancy is ours to lose. For those living inside the wall, the fears are of a different sort. They are fears known only to people who have no future. To get in or out of their hometown, they must pass through a security checkpoint. This is a technicality for tourists, but for the residents of Bethlehem and the West Bank, the wall engenders the sort of fear that fuels anger. Visible anger. Once inside the town, you can see the fury of that anger in the graffiti that covers the wall. You can also hear at dawn, noonday, mid-afternoon, dusk, and sometime in the silent night, the minarets calling the town's Muslim majority to prayer. Presently, Palestinian Christians have left not only the little town of Bethlehem, but most of the Middle East. Only Christian pilgrims line up to descend the narrow steps leading to the grotto underneath the Church of the Nativity in Major Square, where Jesus was born. There in the dark, someone usually begins to hum, then sing in English or German or Japanese, Silent Night. When I think of Bethlehem today, I think of a little town where a multitude of human fears are met on both sides of a wall. Fears gone viral this Advent in the aftermath of Lebanon and Paris and San Bernardino. Fears become legion in the faces of millions who no longer have a home or a future. What then of the hopes of all the years met in Bethlehem? For Micah, an 8th century prophet, say that hope was in short supply. The Neo-Assyrian army had conquered and deported most of Israel, the northern kingdom. It is thought that Micah himself had been an eyewitness to the destruction of Judah, the southern kingdom, in 701 BC, prompting him to write oracles of doom. But after hearing God's judgment above the deep and dreamless sleep, Micah also hears God's promise. He wrote that out of the little town of Bethlehem, one of the smallest clans of Judah, a ruler whose origin was of old would be born of a woman. The ruler would return the exiles and feed them on the strength of the Lord like a shepherd. Under the rule of the one of peace, they would dwell secure. These hopes have not changed in almost 3 millennia. As it turned out, Micah was right about the fears and premature concerning the hopes of his time. Likewise, in the 6th century BC, a few hundred years later, exiles heard in those same words of Micah a word of hope spoken to them in exile in Babylon. God's promise of a ruler hopes and fears of all the years no longer seemed plausible. After 70 AD, the land had been lost once again, the temple was in ruins, the people were scattered. Israel's shepherds, reed politicians, were no more than hirelings. Remember that Luke is writing the beginning of his gospel after writing most of Luke and all of Acts. He goes back to write a beginning. And he's writing a beginning for his readers in the ruins, where the future is no longer a blank waiting to be filled in by whatever promises someone may bring. The future is already occupied by death. And death, according to Robert Jensen, don't we all know, reinterprets all promises and hopes the same way. It might have been. It might have been. But literally in the face of death, Luke begins to write a new beginning of his gospel. A beginning he can only write because he already knows the humanly inconceivable ending. An ending to a risen Lord, death defeated. Assuring Theophilus, his reader, that what he's about to tell him is true because it has been handed on to him by eyewitnesses, he begins the story with a barren woman and follows that story with the story of a virgin, both pregnant. In other words, he begins to tell Theophilus a story about the God who alone creates a future where there is no future. The first woman's son will be born in the hill country of Judah. The second woman's son will be born in Bethlehem. No doubt Luke believed the son born of Mary was the one promised 8 centuries before by the prophet Micah. Yet I repeat, Luke believed this not because of the birth of Mary's son. He believed this because of the death and resurrection of God's son. People would live secure under the rule of the one of peace because the God who raised Mary's son from the dead had defeated death. That is why the song Luke puts in Mary's mouth is a song set in the past perfect tense. The God who raised Jesus from the dead has looked with favor on the poverty of Mary, has shown strength with his arm, has scattered the proud in the imaginations of their hearts, has brought down the powerful and lifted up the lowly, has filled the hungry with good things and has sent the rich empty away, has helped his servant Israel. God has already done all these things. God has created a future where there was no future for the poor, the hungry, the outcast, the brokenhearted, and for those who must die. nature given to the least and the lonely, the poor and the oppressed, is a song heard on the other side of the wall as a future taken away. When the Magnificat is said or sung in a congregation such as ours, and in a time such as this, any who are really listening can only conclude that the lyrics are bad news before they are good news. But simply, Mary's hopes are precisely our fears. The God who looks with favor on her poverty is the same God whose judgment puts reverse spin on our pride and power and possessions. The God gestating in her womb, the God who has lifted up the lowly and filled the hungry with good things, is the God who has scattered the likes of us in the imaginations of our hearts, has cast down those of us who have made it, and has sent us away with nothing in the bank. Apparently, the hopes and fears of all the years are a zero-sum game. And yet, what if God's judgment against the future we are afraid to lose is as merciful toward us as God's promise is to those who have no future? My guess is that some of you this morning know what it is to lose the future you thought you had secured by your brains or your brawn, by following the rules that worked in your favor, by marrying well or raising high-achieving children who in turn fed your pride. When the future is in your hands, the pressure is enormous to keep everything under your control. And if it should come to pass that your control begins to slip, the energy required to keep up appearances is even more enormous. Mary sings more than she knows. Pride and power and possessions turn out to be precarious prizes that have the privileged more than the privilege ever really have them. So here is the redemptive question that Mary's song poses to our lives in the dark of Christmas Eve. What if all the hopes and fears of all the years in us is a zero-sum game? What if the hope waiting to meet us in Bethlehem will free us from all of our fears, save the one fear which is really worthwhile? Fear of God coming toward us. What if the vulnerability our pride and power and possessions have tried to deny is the vulnerability for which we were made, the vulnerability we meet in the manger? What if the loss and death that terrifies us most is the loss and death necessary if ever we are to be truly human? What if the future we have constructed is no future at all, not discover the direction and the hope which Christ grants us, Karl Barth of Christmas, we can only discover our own lack of all these things and our own contradiction against them. We can only wait in expectation and pray that Luke is telling the truth, that the hopes and fears of all our years has met us in a manger and on a cross. Each year you are born again, the poet Robert Cordy writes in his Advent stanzas. It is no remedy from what we go on doing to each other, for history's blind repetition of hate and reprisal. Here I am again, huddled in hope. For what do I wait? I know you only as something missing and loved beyond reason. As a word in my mouth, I cannot embody. Soon comes the night we have given to your birth. After the cherished hymns, the prayers, the story of one who became peacemaker, healer of the sick, the one who feeds the hungry and raises the dead, we light small candles and stand in the dark of the church, hoping for peace a child knows, hoping to forget career, mortgage, money, hoping even to turn quietly away from the blind, reductive selves inside us. Come, O come, Emmanuel. I am a ghost waiting to be made flesh by love. I am too imperfect to bear. Nevertheless, where meek souls